From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you're a beer drinker who wants to enjoy a nice cold one, you certainly won't have a problem locating your favorite beverage. Cans and bottles take up entire aisles in the grocery stores. Bars and restaurants have almost every brand available. There are even some eateries that brew their own specialty beers and lagers. Given the ready availability of and access to beer in all of its incarnations, why would anyone want to brew their own? And if you want to brew your own, what do you have to know? How much time will it take? And will it be worth the effort? Evidently, lots of people believe in brewing beer on their own and that it is worth the effort, and many of them converged on Mooresville for the 18th annual U.S. Open Home... Let me do this again. The 18th annual U.S. Open Homebrew Competition. They brew what is called craft beer, and they're showcasing the results of their efforts at the competition. At least they did last week. Rick Benfield is president of the Carolina Brewmasters Club, a nonprofit whose members, and I quote, enjoy making, tasting, sharing, and enjoying beer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Rick joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with John Stritch, president of Carolina Beer and Beverage in Mooresville, the brewers of Carolina Blonde and Cottonwood Ale Craft Beer Products, and a sponsor of the U.S. Open Home Brew Competition. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
And Matt Siegel is director of marketing and entertainment at the Carolina Renaissance Festival, which sponsors home brewing competitions like the Gambrinus Cup in the fall, in addition to sponsoring the U.S. Open competition. Matt, good to see you again as well.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
We're talking about, I think, I don't know very much about this, as it will become apparent as we go through this hour, but I think we're talking about two different things when we talk about home brewing and craft beer, are we not? Because you're not a home brewer at Carolina Blonde, but you are considered a craft beer, correct?
That is correct. Craft beers are local beers. Generally, they're not nationally distributed. Mm-hmm. We brew for regions, and the home brewers are kind of our lifeline. These are people that understand the brewing of beer and the intricacies and the possibilities of brewing great brews, and they're some of our best supporters.
So the beer that made Milwaukee famous, we won't name the brand, but the beer that made Milwaukee famous could have been considered a craft beer until it became nationwide?
Well, I guess in Milwaukee they might say that.
Would that not be fair to say? I mean, seriously.
Mike, I don't want to get off on a tangent because it would take too long, but what happened was coming out of Prohibition, everybody was a home brewer,
right,
a home winemaker and everything else for that the noble experiment. It went south on the country, and coming out of it, across the country, every neighborhood had a brewer. And when it came out, unfortunately for small brewers, the people craved what they called premium brands. And it was the guys that stayed in business, like the Bushes and the Millers and the Elines from Schlitz, that ended up taking advantage of that opportunity. It wasn't until the 70s that the craft brewing industry got to reemerge.
Now, John just said, Rick, that the home brewers are their lifeline of these craft brewing companies, the companies that build the boutique brands that are regionally distributed. Why would that be so?
Well, we have certainly an appreciation for beer, number one, and appreciation for good beer, number two, since we, as home brewers, like to brew the styles that we really like to drink. Sometimes we think outside the box and brew some really funky styles of beer. We appreciate the craft brews and the microbrews and the folks of that nature that are able to produce fun beers for us to drink.
Mm-hmm. Funky beers, what would that mean?
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, when I say funky, it's probably the wrong word. It may tend to think that somebody's got a bad beer on their hands. It's basically brewing outside the box. We have the ability with the ingredients that we have to brew all sorts of different styles of beer that are difficult possibly to get on a local level, like your Belgian type beers and some of your German beers that you can't just get off the shelf. Mm-hmm. So we're able to do things within our beers, such as adding additional hops to make it that wonderful, bitter, flowery beer say in an IPA. Mm-hmm. So we're able to tweak our recipes to brew the styles that we like that we just can't get in the store.
So you're not unlike wine connoisseurs who would turn their nose up at Two Buck Chuck.
Absolutely.
What do you turn your nose up at? Be gentle now. As you go down the grocery store aisle, would you not buy most of the beers in the cold case?
Absolutely not. I bypassed the big boys and look directly for it.
Why? Because there's no flavor? Because why?
Yeah, basically because there's no flavor.
Okay. They brewed the flavor out for American tastes?
I don't think they've brewed the flavor out. They are brewing with ingredients that are inexpensive to get, and it's all bottom-line profit dollars for them, mm-hmm. is to kick out styles that include rice or include corn that just give it beer.
It's kind of bitter carbonation.
Yeah.
Okay. Matt Siegel is with us also. He's from the Renaissance Festival, and they do sponsor a beer brewing competition, and we're sponsors here of the 18th Annual U.S. Open Homebrew Competition in Mooresville last week, and in fact give out a prize at that. But why is the Renaissance Festival involved in beer?
Well, like John said earlier about home brewers being the lifeline, being big supporters, we feel that they are also big supporters of the Renaissance Festival. They represent an eclectic group, an eclectic mix of people, anywhere from lawyers to doctors to engineers to chemists to real estate agents. The club itself, mm-hmm. consists of a great mix of people, and is the type of people that you would see at the Renaissance Festival as well.
And beer was big during the Renaissance, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It was a drink of choice.
Oh, yeah, and it's one of the many unique food items that we do offer at the Renaissance Festival. Giant roasted turkey legs. I keep joking with Rick that they need to start brewing a beer and add that flavor to it, the roasted turkey leg. That'd be great.
You could probably do that, couldn't you?
You could do anything. Whether it's good or not, it's another story.
Mooresville, to me, strikes me as an interesting place, an odd place, for the 18th annual U.S. Open homebrew competition. Is it always in Mooresville, or does it float around the country?
Well, in the past, it has floated around locally. This is the U.S. Open is actually hosted by the Carolina Brewmasters.
Okay.
That is our club competition. We belong to the CBOY, which is the Carolina Brewer of the Year. We have clubs throughout the Carolinas that host their own competitions, and this just happens to be our competition that we host in May of every year. Mm-hmm. The past several years, the folks at Carolina Beer have been gracious enough to let us in on their Saturday afternoon and allow us to have our competition there.
How many home brewers are there in the area, do you know?
That's a good question. Our club itself has upwards of 130 paid members right now, and there are plenty more in the Charlotte region that aren't members of our club that do homebrew.
Mm-hmm. For every person that's brewing their own, they're not drinking yours. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, actually, that's not true. The we host tours every Saturday. Mm-hmm. We've got a very nice, if you haven't been there, we've got a 5,000-square-foot tasting room, 60-foot bar, 15 beers on tap, and we get to show people how we make beer and also let them taste the whole array of our beers, from our lightest beer, a 84-calorie, low-calorie beer called the Carolina Lighthouse, all the way up to our stouts. It's a great facility, and we have homebrewers come every Saturday, and they enjoy bringing us samples and enjoy drinking our beer. Homebrewers, when they really hit a home run on something, what they'll end up doing is kind of cherishing that beer. They aren't drinking it as their regular beer. They're doing that, and then they save that for special occasions, for special friends, to share when they go to the monthly meetings but generally when they're drinking during the week with their friends and family, they'll drink craft beers.
What you have to remember is that we're brewing typically in 5-gallon batches, maybe 10-gallon batches. So that batch only lasts so long. So we tend to get a little selfish.
Well,
with
how long
it.
Does a 10-gallon batch last?
That's it depends on how much you like it.
one of the definitions of a craft brewery is that it produces a limited amount of beer. The exact amount, it seems to me, varies, but it's usually around, I read yesterday, 15,000 barrels or 475,000 gallons a year. You produce 35 million cases annually. I read that yesterday, too. Is that does that equate, or is that a fair definition of a craft brewery?
Well, we're actually a fine beverage maker, which means we make beer as our own brands, our proprietary brands, but we manufacture higher-end beverages in bottles, cans, plastic for the major U.S. and some international beverage companies.
So you're brewing other people's recipe?
Not necessarily beer, but we do energy drinks.
Oh, okay.
We're kosher. We're an organic product. Make organic teas, health-enhancing antioxidant mm-hmm. beverages.
Wow.
We've got a very sophisticated manufacturing process, starting with reverse osmosis, water treatment. Most modern blending system in the country, and then we also have thermal process, which means that there's a lot of people now that don't want to put in preservatives in their products, and to do that you have to thermally process it, which is pasteurization, mm-hmm. and we have that capability. We just put a new bottle line in that expanded our capacity to upwards of 40 million cases a year. But last year, I think we did 15 million cases, and this year we've doubled our capacity. So, and we're off to a very good start.
When a home brewer goes to, and we're going to talk about the process of doing this because I want people to understand what we're talking about here and what equipment they need to do this and how long it takes and is it worth the effort. But when a home brewer decides to do this and has maybe some experience under his or her belt, so it's not a new experience for them, what are they trying to achieve? Are they just trying to brew something that is different from what's commercially available, or are they trying to brew something that's better than what is commercially available? And do they always hit the mark? And if you don't hit the mark, you got 10 gallons sitting there. What do you do with it?
Well, the worst beer I've ever had was great that I made. So it's difficult to throw out a batch of beer. I have done that in the past, however. But basically, when a home brewer begins brewing, they're just really trying to learn the process about how to make beer. That's how I got started. Mm-hmm. It was basically, I want to make beer. And hopefully it was going to taste good after I made it.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, as you get a little more experienced, you are wanting to brew the style of beer that you prefer to drink. And then as you get a little bit better, you start thinking again a little bit outside the box and brewing some styles that may be a little bit more difficult to brew and to ferment along the way. So really they start out just trying to learn the process of how to brew beer and then go from there.
That's Rick Benfield. He's president of Carolina Brewmasters Club. John Stritch is also with us. He's president of Carolina Beer and Beverage, makers of Carolina Blonde. And Matt Siegel with the Carolina Renaissance Festival and the sponsors of the Gambrinus Cup for the home brewer. We're going to continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And WFAE programming is funded by DCI Home Resource, a complete design resource for traditional and contemporary custom cabinetry, luxury plumbing, and gourmet appliances, including Sub-Zero, Wolf, Viking, and Miele at DCI Showroom in Charlotte's South End. And by Dr. James Altizer at the Vein Center of Charlotte, providing state-of-the-art outpatient treatment for varicose and spider veins. Trust the vein specialists. 704-341-1122. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, it's a holiday archive of the program. We'll replay our interview from earlier this year with Ira Flatow, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. We'll discuss his passion for science and how he works to pass that interest on to young people. Charlotte Talks tomorrow morning at 9, right here on WFAE 90.7.
Patriotism and love of country have been campaign issues since the founding of our country. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams face questions about their devotion to the new nation. As we celebrate Independence Day, we examine evolving views on patriotism, the Diane Rehm Show, Thursday.
Tune in to Diane Rehm from 10 to noon here on WFAE.
Next time on The World, Israel went to war with Hezbollah in 2006 to retrieve two captured soldiers. Now the soldiers are to be returned in exchange for Hezbollah prisoners. The swap is controversial in Israel, but in Lebanon, it's seen as a major victory for the Iranian-backed militant group. High times for Hezbollah, next time on The World.
Listen for that story and the news tonight at 7, here on 90.7 WFAE.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about home brewing today, beer and whatnot. Rick Benfield is with us. He's the president of the Carolina Brewmasters Club. John Stritch, president of Carolina Beer and Beverage, makers of Carolina Blonde and Cottonwood Ale, among other products. And Matt Siegel is the director of marketing and entertainment for the Carolina Renaissance Festival. They are one of the sponsors of the 18th annual U.S. Open Home Brew Competition, which took place in Mooresville last week. You just told me that there were about 330 people who entered that competition. And you, the Renaissance Festival, gives out one of the prizes there, the Gambrinus Cup.
Absolutely. The Gambrinus Cup is a large, handcrafted Renaissance Festival artisan mug, and that's just one portion of the actual prize that we give out. The highly coveted aspect of the prize amongst the homebrewers is the opportunity for their winning recipe to be brewed at Carolina Beer and Beverage in Mooresville and then offered to the public at the Renaissance Festival in the fall. We have a special event weekend that takes place in the fall that we have homebrewers come out and actually demonstrate the brewing of beer during the Renaissance time period. You asked earlier with the, if they use medieval equipment. They basically do. They brew the beer over an open fire, and they run down the steps of how you brew your own beer. It's really neat to see. But throughout the whole run of the Renaissance Festival, that winning Gambrinus beer is offered to the public for the whole 7 weekends that we operate.
Do you bring your own judges in to award the Gambrinus Cup, or do you use the judges that the U.S. Open has been using for the other prizes that are handed out?
We use the same judges, and they are, I believe it's BJCP,
that's correct,
nationally certified judges. They undergo a
certification
program.
So what are you looking for that they wouldn't be looking for the other prizes that are given out?
Well, Mike, I got to trust the judgment on, from Rick and John Stritch here at Carolina Beer and Beverage. They, prior to the competition, we do narrow it down to a category style of beer, one that would have been offered during the 16th or wouldn't have been able to be created during the 16th century, and one that the public would like. We narrow it down to those categories, and then we get the word out to the homebrewers ahead of time to let them know that this is what you want to shoot for. And then they entered their beer specifically for that category in the competition.
What kind of beer won the Gambrinus Cup? I'm just curious.
It was an English pale ale.
And what distinguished it from some of the others, or even some of the winners in the past?
Sure. Rick, I'll probably toss that
over
to you.
This year, they decided, Matt and his group decided that the Gambrinus Cup would be awarded in the English Pale Ale category.
Okay.
And that category actually has three subcategories: a standard ordinary bitter, a special best premium bitter, and an extra special strong bitter, or an ESB, as some people tend to know that better. The past several years, we've had Wee Heavies, which is a Scottish-style beer. We've had, last year, I think it was the Porter category, that was chosen to be the Gambrinus Cup-style winner. Mm-hmm. And this year we had, I don't know how many entries in the Category 8, but the beer that actually won that Gambrinus Cup was the Special Best Premium Bitter.
Mm-hmm. Now, Matt just mentioned that the winner of this gets to have a limited edition of their beer mass-produced, so to speak, by your brewery, John. What's it like to take a home recipe and expand it out so that you can bottle X number of cases of this stuff? Does it taste the same when you're done with it, or do things happen because you have to alter the recipe to make enough beer to bottle?
Well, what we do, and it's a fun experience for a home brewer to do, is they bring their recipe, mm-hmm. and then we'll expand it to probably a 25 barrel, which would be a 300 case or, you know, 50 keg version. And they get to, we use their yeast, and that's why we have to do the competition now, because depending on whether it's an ale yeast or a lager yeast, it can take anywhere from 3 weeks to 2 months to ferment and age. So at this time, it gives us enough time. We set up, we order the ingredients in special. The brewer comes in, home brewer comes in, works with our brewer and actually does the brewing, is there when we're transferring it into the fermenter, and then can come back periodically to check how the beer's maturing and aging, and then we will package it. We never, we'll of course do a little sampling ahead of time, but we tap the first keg at the Renaissance Festival.
Now, if this were to become a runaway seller, would you then want to continue producing it? And if so, would you have to pay the...
that would be nice.
would you have to pay for the recipe rights?
No, actually,
you already know the recipe.
No, actually, what we have to do is we have to register the brand with the state and with the TTB in Washington, so it actually becomes our brand. But generally, we have we cover a wide variety of beers with the cottonwood flavors, and a lot of our cottonwood flavors are seasonal, so they'll jump from year to year. That's really probably one of the biggest differences between a national brewery and the craft style beers. Is craft brewers are more flexible. Where you get a national company, they want to, their objective is to hit a 2 or 3 share of market, which is an immense amount of beer.
Sure.
For them to even entertain putting it in the marketplace. For craft brewers, we do seasonals. We try different things. And even the most seasoned, like an Anchor Steam, they do a seasonal Christmas ale. They change it every year.
But how do you get shelf space?
Well, with shelf space, just like anything else in America, it's very competitive. Yeah. They're checking Nielsen's, and now the stores have their own sales data, so they know how much they sold that week.
Right.
So our beers do well enough to earn space in the cooler.
We did a show on a couple of years ago on beer, where we went right across the street, as a matter of fact, to Rock Bottom, where they have a little mini brewery, a microbrewery. And we talked to the brewmaster there and several other people as well, and it became readily apparent that the brewing of beer is both an art and a science. And it's very time-consuming, and there are lots of stages and lots of different things that go into the beers, and you got to monitor it all the way through, and it seemed to me to be very complex. How difficult is this for the average person to do at home on a small scale?
Actually, it's very easy to do. It's when you start entering competitions and really trying to hit that style guideline for competition becomes a little bit more difficult. But just to brew beer, it's a very easy process. It's all science and chemistry, and I wish I had known that when I was in high school. I would probably aced chemistry.
Practical application.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
But it's, the brewing of beer is basically... You're taking either your grains or an extract of those grains, and you are boiling that beer water or wort for an hour or so, and then you're adding at different times of that boil hops, and it could be different styles of hops to give you bitterness and aroma. And
it sounds complicated already.
Well, it is in the beginning, but once you know what you're doing, it's certainly secondhand.
I want to talk about the process from beginning to end here in a second, but we have a call, so put your headphones on. Let's go to Steel Creek. Mike, welcome to the program. Interesting question that he has, I think.
Yeah, morning. I wanted to ask about gluten-free beers. Probably about 8 years ago, I noticed that I had something called celiac disease, and I have not had beer since then, and just last Christmas I got a great present from Santa, and it was gluten-free beer, and it seems to be making this emergence. I'm just wondering what you guys think of it, and would Carolina Brewing Company maybe consider making a beer?
Actually, that's a good question, and we have made that consideration. I think it's a viable market. The biggest process in getting it to the shelf is making the commitment for the packaging. The packaging's incredible. When you're ready to put something on the shelf, then you know what you're talking about is you're talking about creative on your labels, legal approval, and then your closures, your caps, six pack carriers, cartons. So really, before we put anything on the marketplace, there's about a $50,000 commitment to that particular packaging. And so what we're doing all the time, because we're a small company, is weighing in which new brands we're going to take to market. But now for draft beer, that is a viable alternative, and that's where we're getting more creative. And, Mike, you know, sustainability is big with our company. We were actually named the Environmental Company of the Year in Iredell County.
Wow.
We recycle everything. We're the biggest recycler in our county. And what we push, in fact, we sell kegerators at the brewery. It's the most energy friendly. It's the most sustainable way to consume beer. And what you're doing is you're refilling the same container. It's better than even recycling. Aluminum is the next friendly, but so if we did a gluten-free, then all you'd have to do is come up and buy a kegerator from us, and we'll keep you in stock at home.
There's so many ingredients in beer, but I know that one of the things that you do not use in your beers, as I understand it, where other mass-produced beers, they do use rice. You use barley. So if you use rice, is there less gluten in the beer? Because there are other ingredients. Is there less gluten in the beer if you use rice as the main ingredient?
You know, that's a question that I don't know.
Sorry, go ahead, Mike.
If you use rice or sorghum, which is a very common ingredient for gluten-free beers, you have zero gluten. Gluten comes from barley, wheat, spelt, oats, and rye.
So some of the national brands, and what I read yesterday, have been criticized for their use of rice. Is there a national brand of beer that might already be gluten-free?
Yes.
We don't know about it?
Well, yes, there is.
What is it, Mike?
It's Anheuser-Busch makes a beer called Red Bridge, which you can get pretty much anywhere, but, you know, like most things, you know, especially with beer, you want variety. That's why I'm asking.
Ah, okay. All right. Anybody want to jump in here?
Well, I've actually given some thought about brewing a gluten-free beer. I have a coworker who has those allergies.
Well, let's talk about, because maybe Mike could do it himself.
He might could do it. It might be a great opportunity for him to do that.
Would your family go for that, Mike?
I would gladly go for that. I'd love to come up to the brewery and talk to you about it. To be honest with you, I'm a designer, and if it means getting Carolina Brewing Company all that packaging, I'd be happy to come in and be an official taste tester and work for free.
That's quite an offer.
Leave your number. but he could join the club, the Carolina Brewmasters Club.
Well, certainly.
And learn to brew his own.
Absolutely.
Right? All right. Mike, good luck to you. You can call John Strich and put your resume in if you'd like. Very quickly, because it's a pretty complicated process. At least it sounds like it is. And we have a lot of people holding on here. Talk me through the process. If I'm a first-time beer maker, like Mike, and I'm trying to brew a beer either because I want something I can't get or because I just want to have a hobby, what must I have? What equipment must I have to begin?
Well, it's very simple, and most beginning brewers actually cook on their stovetop at the house. Basically, you buy an extract kit from a local homebrew supply store, and basically the extract is already that product that we get from soaking our grains. So basically you're taking a liquid extract or a dry extract and you're pouring it into a cooking vessel, some type of pot on the stove, let's say. You're adding water. Bring that to a boil. And during the process, you're adding different types of hops. And then you take that mixture, that wort, and you want to cool it down to approximately 70 degrees. Cooling that down
Already I need a pot and a thermometer.
A pot and a thermometer, okay. Correct. Then you want to be able to cool that down. So basically, put some ice in your kitchen sink, set your tub down in that sink, and let that cool down to about 70 degrees.
Okay.
From there, you need a 5-gallon bucket with an airlock on the top because you don't want any air getting into that 5-gallon bucket. And you're adding your yeast to that mixture. And the
so
yeast,
you're pouring the mixture from the pot that you cooked it in into the bucket, and you're adding yeast, and you're closing the lid.
And you're closing the lid, and you let the yeast do its thing.
For how long?
It just depends. Sometimes it only takes 3 days to fully ferment.
And you keep that at room temperature?
It depends on the style that you make and the type of yeast that you use. Typically, fermentation temperatures for most ales are going to be in the 65, 68 range.
And why doesn't that explode?
Well, it doesn't explode, but you can get some blow off is what we say. If it actually, during the fermentation process, it will rise and fall within that vessel. And sometimes you will actually get some of that stuff that collects at the top that will actually come out the airlock. But it will not explode if it's done correctly.
So this, you have to buy this specially. This is not just some bucket you buy and put a top on it. This has to be sealed and with an escape valve on it. Correct?
Absolutely. But it's very inexpensive.
So you buy this where?
Buy it at our local homebrew supply store's Alternative Beverage in Belmont. They've just moved recently.
Okay.
And he has everything that you would need.
And so this sits for a couple. How do you know when it's done?
Well, when it's fermenting, the airlock that you have, you've got water in that airlock, and it'll bubble. And when it stops bubbling, you pretty much know that the fermentation process is over with.
Okay. And then what do you do with it?
Well, then you would...
It's not beer yet, right?
At that point in time, yes, it's
it
beer.
Okay.
Yes. Sometimes people will go directly to a bottle or a keg from that. Other people will go to a secondary fermenter to let it condition. And conditioning, you're just letting the beer settle itself out a little bit. You've still got some yeast that's floating around in that. You allow the yeast to float down to the bottom of that secondary fermenter. And you let that sit for another week or two, however long. Mm-hmm. And then you'll either bottle or keg.
You have how much here in your container? 5 gallons?
Typically a 5-gallon batch. Some people brew 3-gallon batches.
What do you do with 5 gallons of something? You stick it in the refrigerator? You could keg it yourself and stick it in the refrigerator?
Well, I personally keg my beer.
Okay.
So I'll put it in my little kegerator, and I'll hook the CO2 up to it, and basically it adds the carbonation.
Ah, I was going to get to that. There's no when you say it's beer already after the yeast is done with it, it's really not the beer that we know because there's no carbonation in it.
That is correct.
Is all beer artificially carbonated, or does it sometimes create its own carbonation?
Well, it will sometimes create its own carbonation. Mm-hmm. Typically, what will happen when folks bottle their beer, they'll add priming sugar, which is basically corn sugar. They'll boil that in a pint of water. They'll pour that into their bottling bucket and then pour or siphon from the fermenter into that. And the corn sugar primes that beer for bottle conditioning and carbonating. And then you just cap the bottle. And typically, it depends on the style of beer, but I would say in a bottle, it takes a good 3 or 4 weeks for it to condition.
But beer should be fresh.
Absolutely.
When do you throw it out?
When it's an empty bottle or an empty keg.
You're serious about this stuff, aren't you? You're a purist.
Absolutely.
All right. That's Rick Benfield, who's president of Carolina Brewmaster Club. John Stritch is with us with Carolina Beer and Beverage, and Matt Siegel from the Renaissance Festival. Continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks right here on 90.7 WFAE, where our programming is funded by Hunton & Williams, a global law firm that believes the practice of law should include community service. More information on Hunton & Williams' legal capabilities online at hunton.com. And by Hendrick Lexus in Charlotte, featuring the innovative RX400H with Lexus Hybrid Drive. More information is available at lexus.com. Well, coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, starting at 10, a look at historical and contemporary beliefs about patriotism in the United States of America. That's in the 10 o'clock hour. And then in the 11 o'clock hour, Jimmy Smith talks about new acting roles and revisits favorites from the past, from L.A. Law to NYPD Blue to his West Wing character, modeled after an up-and-coming Barack Obama. That's the Diane Rehm Show starting at 10 o'clock this morning. Well, today, sunny with a high near about 92, and then tomorrow, sunny with a high near 93. Chance of showers moves in Saturday with mostly cloudy skies and a high near 89.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition from NPR News. While you've been sleeping, we've been awake. Just barely in some cases, but nevertheless awake watching the world. From Baghdad to your backyard and all points in between. You can tune in and get prepared now for the day ahead with up-to-the-minute news, background analysis, commentary, and the latest on arts and sports. Wake up to the world with Morning Edition from NPR News.
With regional news, weather, and traffic, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
WFAE explores the lighter side of storytelling.
Well, I used to be a karaoke DJ in a restaurant, and I used to always cab drive, so the restaurant closed down, so I just put it on the road, put it in my car, and started driving around.
If you missed a recent feature on Charlotte's one and only karaoke cab, you'll find it and other past stories in our news archives at our website, WFAE.org.
Shake that healthy food! Baby got bad!
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about beer in the aftermath of, that's an odd word to use, of the 18th annual U.S. Open Homebrew Competition in Mooresville just last week. With Rick Benfield, who's the president of the Carolina Brewmasters Club, they put together this competition. John Stritch is president of Carolina Beer and Beverage, the makers of Carolina Blonde and Cottonwood Ale, and they are part of this competition as well. They actually brew the winner of the Gambrinus Cup, which is a prize awarded to a particular beer by the Carolinas Renaissance Festival. And Matt Siegel is with us from that. Given the time that it takes to brew beer, and I know that you have brewers out there at the festival brewing as they might have done in the 1300s, the 1400s, do people get to taste these beers? I know the festival runs 7 weeks. Can they actually brew something the first weekend of the festival, and then by the seventh weekend, if you come back, the beer is ready to taste?
No, not necessarily. We wish it would work out that way, but you have to respect the time that it does take to brew the beer, especially using medieval equipment. It's going to take a little bit longer, too. The public is not able to sample the beer that's being brewed at that time. They can just watch the process and learn and view the demonstration and speak with the brewers and ask questions about how it works. But they are able to sample a wide variety of other beverages that we offer, like the Winning Gambrinus product that will be ready, as well as some of the Cottonwood products and Carolina beer and beverage products as well.
We have an email here from a listener who says, how do you avoid reaching underage drinkers with your marketing? And I guess that's directed at your brewery, but also I would think to the Renaissance Festival, because the Renaissance Festival is unquestionably a family affair. Mm-hmm. So how do you keep a lid on things in terms of consumption?
Well, we do. We do check IDs regularly, constantly. We have a very strict program in place for checking IDs. And then at the event where we brew the beer and have the demonstration taking place, not only are we checking IDs, but we're also wristbanding individuals. So as they enter to sample some of the products that are available, they are easily identifiable as being over the age of 21.
Mm-hmm. What about marketing a major brand?
Well, I think what the reader's concerned about is mass marketing mm-hmm. that's appealing to the youth. Generally, you know, I go back to my youth, which was a long, long time ago, and my appreciation of wine now. You know, the first wine people normally drink would be like a wine cooler, something really sweet and stuff like that, and then as they mature and as their tastes mature, mm-hmm. they get into more subtle tastes and drier wines and things like that. Beer is much the same way. All the beers that we make generally are for people that really appreciate the a little bit more flavor and type taste like that. But as far as advertising goes, generally we're only direct any marketing dollars at places where the majority of the people are drinking age or up. Our target drinker really is not the not the 21-year-old. It's the 25 to 50-year-old person.
Can you homebrew a non-alcoholic beer?
I guess you can. I wouldn't attempt it because it's just a waste of time. And money, you know, you can go to the store and get the non-alcoholic, products out there,
But if you're looking for the flavor that you guys are brewing because you can't get a certain flavor off the grocery store shelves, but you don't want the alcohol, it can be done. Or are there any places you could go, like to a library and get a recipe or some construction manual? Because brewers, the professional brewers do it.
Generally, non-alcoholic beers are beers that are made and then the alcohol is removed afterwards.
How do you do that? Burn it off? What do you do?
Well, it's actually a very sophisticated process, and only the largest breweries really do it. And it's a smaller segment of the market. There's, you know, for people that like the taste of real beers and stuff, there's ginger beers, things like that that don't use yeast, so there is no alcohol ever entered into the system. Mm-hmm. It's a small category,
right.
And
my understanding is, and Rick can correct me if I'm wrong, is alcohol is more of a byproduct of the brewing process. It's not the focus of a home brew,
right.
Someone who brews their own beer to achieve a higher gravity content in their beer solely for the purpose of being able to enjoy the higher alcohol content. It's more so for the flavor and the quality and the freshness that comes with brewing your own beer.
Is the alcohol content dependent on the kind of yeast or the amount of yeast that you put in the brew process?
Not really. It's basically the amount of grains that you are using in your recipe. Your higher gravity beers use more grains, more malts, more barleys. So the higher percentage of product and grains that you're using is going to give you a higher sugar level, and your yeast certainly will eat those sugars and that wort to create the beer.
Before I go back to the phones, there are a lot of different ingredients we've talked about. You just mentioned malt, then there's the barley, and then there's the yeast. Well, besides the water, which is readily available, where do you buy these ingredients, and how do you know what ingredients you need to brew the kind of beer that your taste buds tell you that you want?
Well, an experienced brewer knows that. A beginning brewer is going to not know those types of things. Basically, in beer, you've got water, and you've got malt, and you've got hops, and you have yeast. Those are the four main ingredients to make beer. Locally, we're able to go to our homebrew supply store. That gentleman actually has prepackaged recipe kits for sale for those beginning brewers with cooking directions, basically, from start to finish, and it's very easily done. As you become more experienced in the brewing process, you then can basically look at recipes online. Just your overall knowledge of the grains and the styles of beer that you want, knowing a style of beer is much easier to be able to develop your recipe.
From start to finish, how much time have you invested in 5 gallons or whatever it is that you come up with at the end of beer? How much time has it taken you from start to finish to get to the finished product?
Typically, I brew ales typically. I don't have a way to lager, which is a longer process. Brewing an ale typically is about a 3-week process from brew day to drink day.
But not constant activity. It just sits in the jug and ferments for a while. So how much time do you have to spend on it?
Well, in my brew day, it's probably a 5 to 6 hour process from startup to cleanup.
Okay. And how much money? For instance, you know if you buy 5 gallons of beer at the store, you know what it costs. How much money does it cost you to brew 5 gallons of beer?
Well, once you have all your equipment in place, it's probably about a $40 investment to brew your own beer.
And what would it cost you to buy that 5 gallons?
It's probably going to depends on the style of beer that you're making. You're making a 5 gallon batch, which is basically 48 12 ounce beers. So, you do the math. you might be, we typically don't brew, for the savings and the money. We brew for the hobby and we
just trying to get to the bottom okay. line here. Is it more expensive?
It could be and it could not be. It depends on the recipe that you're brewing.
And it's okay.
Absolutely.
It's all about what you want to do.
Absolutely.
It's okay. All right, fine. I'm not trying to put you on the spot here. Let's go back to the phones. I'll put your headphones back on, if you would, please. Richard in Boone, you're on the radio.
Well, thanks. I'm enjoying the show. And to follow up on the question about where you source materials, I'm wondering, given that North Carolina has some pretty excellent farmland nearby, whether there's any interest and possibility of sourcing grains or hops, you know, locally, and if on the homebrew level, you know, whether there's interest, and also on the commercial level for the Cottonwood folks, you know, whether they think it might be worth the time and effort it would take to source some of those ingredients locally.
Well, as far as would we be interested in North Carolina ingredients, farming for barley and for hops, absolutely. One of the things they're going to talk about tomorrow is the economy. A thing that's really affected the beer industry is the economy. The drive for ethanol has driven up the price of all grains. So our cost on our barley's grown 40%. The amount of acres planted for barley in the world has dropped, and in the United States has dropped. Corn's a cheap crop, and a lot of farmers are going that way. And then hops, because of a different reason, because of nature and weather and a couple of natural disasters, worldwide we have a hop shortage. So the price of hops this year has gone up 300%. And they've already declared that 2009 is going to be worse. There's a hop shortage around the world. So we invite anybody getting into hops. You're up in Boone, the mountain area up there. That could very easily be a hop farm. What I'm looking at down the road is any time a crop goes up 300%, in America, that means it means landowners and people in agriculture are going to find a way and a reason to plant more hops. But unfortunately, it takes about 3 years to get a good hop farm going.
Why? And,
well, it's because you got to plant the hops, and it takes 3 years to mature the crops. Hops look like the beautiful vine, but it doesn't have the sturdy stems that wines do, just like, you know, growing a wine deal. But it takes about 3 years. It's a neat crop. It dies off every winter during the freeze, and then in the spring, it sprouts up, and they train them on wires. It's a plant that only grows vertical, grows straight up, and it'll grow 20 feet tall. Some days, we've planted them at the brewery for education purposes. We've seen it grow 3 inches in a day. I mean, it's an amazing
wow.
plant.
And I could add to that, we as homebrewers are certainly feeling the effects of the hop shortage. Some of us in our club actually have taken, I have not personally, but some of our members in the club are actually growing their own hops in their backyards. There's a club up in Greensboro that has secured some land, and that club is actually growing their own hops. So it's a very interesting process, and so you know we've had to resort to some drastic measures to be able to get the hops that we need.
Richard, thank you for your call. There's no shortage of turkey legs, is there? Because there would be no Renaissance Festival without the turkey legs.
Absolutely not. We're fine.
Let's go to Greg in Concord. Welcome, Greg.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just have a question for the Carolina Brew Company owners. I was just curious, when you got into the business, how difficult did you find the market in North Carolina, and what did you find to be your single greatest challenge going into the craft beer industry?
Well, we started 10 years ago, and at that time there was a huge growth in craft beers around the United States, and we felt that North Carolina and Charlotte was a great opportunity. So we came out and got into business. And then in about 3 or 4 years, there was a national slowdown on craft beers, and North Carolina experienced it as well. The South isn't quite as strong. We think that the best is in the future. North Carolina has a lot of – there's 25% of the people that in the listening audience that are from other regions. Mm-hmm. We're in here 4 years ago. So what we're seeing is people are coming in from regions like the Northeast, the Northwest, Denver, and they really have an appreciation. There's some markets in the United States where craft beers have 20% of the marketplace. In North Carolina, it's about half the national average.
Yeah, because we don't, unlike Milwaukee, where there's a bar on every corner, we don't have that drinking culture here. We were brown bagging it until about 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So we don't have that in our DNA here, correct?
No, I have to disagree with you on that. I've got a lot of good Southern friends, and beer's been around for, you know, beer is really a beverage of the working man. It always has been, and beer's been a part of North Carolina and South Carolina culture. You know, I mean, beer was brought, the reason that the Pilgrims pulled over, you know, and they would have much rather come to North Carolina, but they ran out of beer, so they ended up at Plymouth Rock. And that's a fact. But no, a lot of European beers, a lot of the trade for the end of the trade run from Europe was dropping kegs off in Charleston.
Greg, thank you for your call. Jay writes, I walked into a place named Alternative Beverage in Belmont, a.k.a. brew.com, and asked what to do. It was very helpful, and for less than $50, I've made my first batch. I did have some materials, carboys, already. I don't know what that means. But as an ongoing thing, 50 bottles cost me about $30 or about 60 cents each, resulting in beer that sells for $8 to $9 a six-pack. Beer only takes 5 weeks from start to drinking. Also, 5 gallons is only about $50, 50 bottles or 2 cases. Sounds like for a beginner, he's got it down.
He's done very well.
Yep. We had a lot of brew pubs here and around the country, and they all kind of just went away. What's up with that? Why?
Well, I don't really think brew pubs have gone away.
Or brew restaurants.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. We're working with a restaurateur down in Charlotte here on South Boulevard, Woods on South, trying to get one going. Rock Bottom, which you mentioned a little earlier, Mike, they're a thriving restaurant, make great beer and everything else. The reason a brew pub is a good program is because beer actually goes better with food than wine.
Who won this competition? Whose beer will you be showcasing as a result of the Gambrinus Cup Award?
Yeah, it's a Charlotte resident. His name is Bruno Wisnowski.
Ooh, good beer name.
Yeah.
Good beer name. Who else won?
Well, I took second place, if that's any consolation. But anyway, that's this particular beer right here took first place in the ESB category.
And it's actually in a bottle.
Absolutely.
Already?
Already.
Did you bottle that yourself?
I did.
Including you have a capping machine?
Oh, yeah. I've got a little capper.
Man. You're serious about this,
absolutely,
aren't you?
Absolutely.
Rick
awesome.
Benfield, president of the Carolina Brewmasters. John Stritch, president of the Carolina Beer and Beverage. Matt Single with the Carolina Renaissance Festival, which comes your way this fall. You can taste the Gambrinus Cup winner.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
And WFAE programming is funded by Lake Norman Realty, serving Lake Norman and the surrounding region since 1978, with 4 locations offering full spectrum of real estate services. Details at lakenormanrealty.com. And by Taylor Richards and Conger and TRCW, featuring hand-selected clothing and accessories for men and women. Phillips Place in Charlotte, Shops on the Green in Cornelius, trcstyle.com.
People you can trust.
Peter Kenyon.
Silvia Poggioli.
Anthony Kuhn.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro.
Jason Beaubien. Don Gagne.
In places that matter.
Gaza. Rome. Beijing.
Baghdad. Johannesburg.
Washington.
The right people in the right places. Every day on All Things Considered.
From NPR News.
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 Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. Awareness of, interest in, and appreciation for science has been on the wane in this country for years, at a time when scientific research is increasingly critical to our economic well-being, and at a time when science is experiencing breakthroughs. Why, and more importantly, how can we instill a passion for science in young people? Ira Flatow, host of NPR Science Friday, joins us to talk about that and about the media's role in all of this in an encore presentation of Charlotte Talks
Friday morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
And this is WFAE 90.7 FM in Charlotte and WFHE 90.3 FM in Hickory. I'm Terry Wilson. Diane Rehm comes up now.
From W.